I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. This show explores the rich heritage of the Brandywine Valley outside Philadelphia, focusing on the people, places, and events over more than 300 years, which have played an important part in our American heritage. Each show highlights a local town, event, or personality who's had a notable influence on our culture. Before we get started, I want to mention our call-in line is 610-701-9243. That's 610-701-9243. This day in history. In 1128, Pope Honorius II officially recognizes the Knights Templar as an army of God, the powerful group participating in the Crusades to the Holy Land in the Middle Ages, gaining stature and influence throughout Europe for centuries, recently highlighted as a mythical sect in the film National Treasure with Nicolas Cage. In 1794, President George Washington adds two stars to the United States flag as Vermont and Kentucky join the Union, beginning a trend in adjusting the banner with each new state, which lasts to the present day. In 1958, country music gets a new outlaw as Johnny Cash flouts authority and the recommendations of his record producers and plays a concert at the Folsom Prison in California, the controversial move gaining media attention and being recorded, later becoming one of the best-selling albums of all time. And in 1982, people around our nation's capital are stunned as an Air Florida jet crashes into the 14th Street Bridge in Washington, D.C., before falling into the Potomac, just 2 miles from the White House, killing 78 people. The plane had been in a snowstorm, which caused its wings to become coated with ice, hindering its maneuverability. The disaster helped bring attention to improved airline safety requirements. Spring City is a town up in the northeastern corner of Chester County outside Philadelphia. Like other twin cities around the country, Spring City and its sister Royersford across the Schuylkill River share a long history which dates back to when commerce flowed along the nation's canals and railroads were poised to change the way we traveled. Spring City's first colonial resident was a fur trapper, Pierre Peter Bazelian, who arrived in the late 17th century and traded with the local Indians. Bazelian was so skilled in dealing with the natives, William Penn asked him to act as an arbiter for Indian affairs. The nearby Zion Lutheran Church began welcoming worshipers more than 30 years before General George Washington and his army marched through the region, the building serving as a hospital for soldiers wounded during the Revolutionary War. Known originally as Pumptown due to a public water well, residents later changed the name to Springtown because of the natural springs in the area. As there was already a town in Pennsylvania with that name, the title was changed to Spring City. The 1800s were the era of canals. More than 3,000 miles of canals were constructed around the nation. The opening of the Schuylkill Canal in 1824 was a major boon to local commerce, allowing easier transport of raw materials from the coal and iron mining regions to the busy port of Philadelphia. The canal's run from Pottstown southeastward spurred the growth of numerous local businesses, including the American Paper Company and the Spring City Stove Company, which shipped what was becoming an essential home appliance domestically and to several countries overseas. Other enterprises such as glassmaking and knitting mills soon followed, making Spring City a major manufacturing town and an important player in the blossoming Industrial Revolution. Today's guest is Bill Brunner, who is president of the Spring Ford Historical Society. The society incorporates the heritage of both Spring City and Royersford and showcases thousands of artifacts at its wonderful museum at 526 Main Street. Bill has written 3 books highlighting the colorful heritage of the region and its many notable people and events over the decades. Bill, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
How long have you been associated with the Spring Ford Historical Society?
Well, I actually have been associated with them since 1988 when I first went down to they had a museum at the train station, and I went down there actually to take pictures of trains, ran into a gentleman by the name of Lawrence Shaner, and I went inside, and I've been hooked ever since. I've been a member since then, been on the board since 1990, and I've been president for the past 12 years.
When was the museum there established?
Well, the museum actually wasn't established until 1988. The society was established 4 years earlier in 84. And when they opened up the museum, it was at the train station. Now, they've moved a couple of times. And the last move, which was our permanent home, we purchased the property on 526 Main Street in Roersford. And that is where we are now located, and that's more or less our permanent home.
Now, I know the museum has a lot of very impressive cast iron stoves from the turn of the century and even well before then. Tell us a little bit about that part of the collection.
Okay. Well, our original museum director, Carolyn Federoff, who passed away 3 years ago, she was a big stove fan. So when the museum first got started, she brought over some of her stoves. And then, of course, we have a lot of stoves that are donated. And currently we have 40 stoves on display. Now, the largest early industry in the two towns was the stove manufacturing. We had three factories in Roersford. We had three in Spring City. And all of our 40 stoves that we have on display were made in one of those factories, the Buckwalter Stove Works being the largest. And then we have Floyd Wells and Grander. Those three were in Roersford in Spring City. You have the original foundry started by James Rogers, which had names from different configurations, Chance and Keeley, Yeager, Hunter. And then even further south on Main, we had the Schuylkill Valley Stove Works, which became Keystone Stove Works. We have stoves from all of those stove companies.
Now, I know that cast iron stoves were a very important part of American family life up through the, 1940s, 1950s. How important was Spring City versus other towns in the U.S. in producing these kinds of stoves?
Well, Spring City, we'll just stick with Spring City. It was very important, but what you have to realize, and I'll make this kind of quick, back in those days, the first purchase, like everybody's first purchase, is their home. And then the next thing you buy is a heater. So you're going to find, if you look at the history all over northeastern Pennsylvania, there were stove factories in many, many towns because it was like the one thing that everybody bought after they bought the house, they bought a stove. So, yes, it was very important in Spring City, but we had a stove works up in Parker Ford and Pottstown. And if you look at the map and you look, the stove works were located anywhere where the resources were available to produce them.
Now, were these stoves burning wood or coal?
Oh, well, in the very beginning, we'll go back, for example, James Rogers, when he started the foundry in 1840, they were making a 9-piece cast iron stove that was a wood burner. People were burning wood. When you get closer to the 1900 in that area, or even a little earlier than that, they were burning coal. The wood burns hotter. It has to have a different type of cast iron, one that's able to withstand the temperatures. But it was in the beginning, it was wood burning, and then later on, they were all coal burning.
Now, a lot of people listening in may think, "Oh, I know what a potbelly stove looks like," but I've seen all the stoves you have there. They're really quite beautiful. These are not typical standard stoves. They're very ornate. Could you describe some of the ironwork on some of those things?
They have many, many patterns, and some of the stove companies actually shared molds, so you might have a different stove with a different name, and when you looked at it, it looked very similar. But the average family would, the industrial town had a lot of double homes. They would buy one heater. It would be in the kitchen, and it would be used for cooking, and it would be for heating. The potbelly stoves would heat one room. They weren't very fancy. The fancy ones that you're talking about, the Poller stoves, they got big nickel-plated domes on the top, and the grates, and all the different little handles. They're all, it looks like chrome. It's actually nickel plate, and they were well done. And then later on, they developed the enameling process, so they had stoves that actually had different colors to appeal to the housewife. But those fancier stoves that you're talking about were more likely to be found in the wealthier people, the store owners, the factory owners, the doctors. The average people that lived in the town would not have those stoves.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some of the most beautiful stoves ever, and they're in your collection. I mean, I've seen several at the Smithsonian, but the stoves there at your museum are really fascinating.
Well, we have a gentleman that has passed away. His name was Pengally. He had a hobby. William Pengally had a hobby, and he collected cast iron stoves. He had, maybe 80 in his collection, and he completely restored them, and it's very expensive to restore an old stove, and that's what he did. And he had some of the ones that really stuck out when you looked at them were from his collection, and when he died, they were on loan to us, but we had the opportunity to purchase them, so we did. That was the largest purchase that we ever made. Normally our budget is like $1,000 a year acquisition, but we purchased the Pengally collection, and all the stoves that we have there now belong to the museum, but some of those fancy ones that you're referring to came out of the Pengally collection.
Yeah, it's very impressive. You also have an extensive collection of antique bottles, glass bottles, and old photographs. What are some of the more interesting items in those collections?
Well, we have one display case. Now, understand, when you get into glass, we got two glass factories in Spring City and two in Roersford. The ones in Spring City were, one was a bottles and the other was plate glass. Over at our museum, we have glassware from all four glass manufacturers. Probably one of there's two cabinets. One has a complete collection of whiskey bottles, which were all made local, and somebody donated the entire collection. I must say they had to really work to empty all those bottles. But there's about 60 bottles in the cabinet, and they're all different, and they're all made locally. And then we have another cabinet, which is called the Whimsy Cabinet. And this is different items that were made after the shift. When workers worked and they completed their shift, they were allowed, if they had wanted to use the leftover glass to make their own little trinkets. And so we had glass canes, chains, vases, darning bottles, all kinds of things that were made by these workers.
Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned one of the big producers was a company called Diamond Glass. Is that right?
Diamond Glass was the largest glass works, and they were the one that operated the longest. They were here up until 1990, and then they were closed. So there are some people that would still remember that. And Diamond Glass made bottles. They made medicine bottles. They made whiskey bottles. They made Avon bottles. They made all kind of bottles. But most of what they're remembered for are the whiskey bottles. And on the bottom of the bottle, there'll be a diamond. And any bottle that you find with a diamond on the bottom was made of Diamond Glass. So you had 100 years of glass making with diamonds on the bottom of the bottle. So
fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Thanks so much. Stay with us. We're going to take a brief break, and then we'll be back with Bill Brunner, the president of the Spring Ford Historical Society, on Living History.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed... could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Are you tired of looking up at that old, streaky, stained, tired, ugly roof? Tired of that ugly roof taking away from your home's curb appeal? G.P. Martini Roofing wants to solve your curb appeal woes with a new roof built with Atlas Pristine Shingles featuring Scotchgard Protector from 3M. The only shingle with a lifetime limited warranty against algae, streaks, and stains. G.P. Martini's crews are highly trained professional installers of asphalt shingle roofs, and now with the power of of Atlas Shingles and Scotchgard Protector from 3M, GP Martini will install a roof that will provide the lasting color you choose for as long as you're in your home. Let GP Martini Roofing have a look at that nagging leak, or just call to consult about upgrading the look for your prized investment. Call them today, 610-873-1696. Whether your need is residential or commercial, GP Martini Roofing has the expertise in-house to solve your problem, or to simply make your home or office look its best. 610-873-1696. That's the number to call. 610-873-1696. And one of those GP Martini trucks will be on its way to you.
This is the Talk of Chester County, 1520 WCHE.
I'm Gene Pasale, and this is Living History. Today we're talking with Bill Brunner, the president of the Spring Ford Historical Society up in Spring City in northeastern Chester County outside of Philadelphia. Bill, you have a lot of other things at your museum there. You have collections of the glass, textiles, a lot of other industries. Tell us a little bit about some of these other industries which we have represented in the museum.
Well, the textile industry would have been the hosiery mills and the knitting mills, and we have a knitting machine on display at the museum, and we have a large photograph display at the museum, and we have thousands of photographs on our computer, and we do have computers in the library that people can access these photographs. I don't know if you want to get into the history of the one of the mills, but I can quickly tell you that, if you want me to, that the Spring City Knitting was started by a gentleman named Ira Gruber, and he was one of 14 children from the Dutch country, from Shoemakersville, and he came to Spring City. And I'll make this story short. He ended up, a few years after he came to Spring City, he ended up getting some money, borrowed some money, started out with one knitting machine and a couple sewing machines. And over the course of two generations, he built the thing up, and it was a $1 million company. And by the time his son, Ed, took over and run the company, it had 16 factories, and it was the largest T-shirt manufacturer in the United States at one time. So there you saw one boy, one of 14 farm boys in Douglas, up in Berks County, come to Spring City and developed the American dream. He developed a factory and a company that was worth millions of dollars.
Yeah, I mentioned you've got a wide representation of industries. This is probably a story that a lot of people aren't aware of. I mean, the largest undergarment and T-shirt manufacturer in the U.S. right in our backyard. I think you mentioned had several plants in Spring City, I think a couple in Arizona. That's a pretty big operation.
It was amazing, you know, what he had and you know, what developed there. And from the way it started, yeah, what you have to realize with our industries is it takes a lot of capital to start a stove factory or a glass factory. But when you get into the knitting industry, you can literally take one knitting machine and one or two sewing machines and have a lady sit there and sew, and the man, Ira, run the knitting machine. Now, you could only make, well, maybe say one size to be profitable, but that's what he did. He had worked at the National Underwear Company for a number of years, and they cheated him out of his money. He started there when he was just a young boy, and they told him they'd put his money away for him, and when he needed it, they would give it to him. And 4 years later, when he wanted to get married, he wanted his money that they were saving for him, and they wouldn't give it to him. And he quit and started his own company. And he was able to do that because a lot of people started their own knitting companies. There were 20 or 30 of them that were started here in the back of somebody's garage. And, of course, they didn't all succeed. But Ira had the experience. He knew the buyers in New York, and he had the contacts. And he started out selling one size underwear, and then everybody laughed at him. And you can't do that. And he said, I can make them, and I can sell them cheaper than anybody else. And, of course, the profits kept plowed back in. And 3 years after he rented a building, in 1910, he actually built the Spring City Knitting Company. 3 years after he started, He paid off the DeWitt brothers, who were a local grocery store, paid them off the money that they loaned him, which was like $500, and went on to build a million-dollar company.
Pretty impressive. I know you have been in the Spring City area for quite a while. Tell us about your background in the area.
Well, I had no choice. My parents moved to Spring City in 1958, and I came along. I went to Springford. I graduated, and I worked a couple of different jobs, and I worked for Firestone up in Pottstown. I worked for Wagner Auto, and then the last 10 years I worked for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I was a caseworker, and I retired in 2001. And I got involved with the Historical Society back, like I had said before, back in 1988 when they had their museum, and then in 1990 I was on the board. I've been heavily involved with the Historical Society since 1990.
No, I remember when you and I talked previously, you have a huge collection of postcards, and in fact have written three books, Spring City and Royersford Postcard Series,
yes,
and Spring City and Royersford Then and Now, and also Through Time. I think at least one of those, maybe most of them, have numerous historic postcards. Tell us a little bit about your collection.
Well, I started collecting back in the early 80s, and my interest in railroads, I started really collecting railroad postcards. And when I ran into Lawrence Shaner, who was my mentor for sure, he collected Spring City Royersford local cards. So he started to tell me where I could go to collect cards. This is before eBay was around.
Mm-hmm.
And I started collecting cards, and I'd save up all my money and go to postcard shows. And I would go up to Renninger's to the flea market, and I started buying postcards. And I concentrated on Spring City and Royersford and Phoenixville, which is where I was born and raised. But anyone that collects and they're a fanatic, I would go to the flea market, and I'd have my money saved up, and I would get there. And if they didn't have Spring City, I'd be buying something else, Royersford or Phoenixville. And then back in 2003, my son gave me a book, an Arcadia publication that was done by Vinnie Martino about Phoenixville. And he said, "Dad, you should do a book." And I said, "Well, I don't know." And he said, "Well, you know," he said, "you really should." And I thought about it, and I sent a letter to Arcadia, and I did a 500-word essay on why we should have a book on Spring City. And they promptly contacted me and said no, it was too small of a town. Mm. And I figured, well, that was the end of my book career. And then they called me up 2 weeks later, and they asked me if I ever heard of Royersford. And I said, "Yeah, I heard of Royersford." And they said, "Well, if you do a book on both, we will publish it." So that's how it ended up being. My first book was a postcard collection, Spring City and Royersford.
Yes, for our listeners, you know, Royersford is literally right across the Schuylkill. It got its name from, I guess, two brothers who started a boat service fording the river.
Benjamin and David Royer came over from Montgomery County. They came over to Chester County, to Spring City, and they purchased grounds in 1801, and they had a farm. And actually, what we call Bridge Street today, which comes down and goes down to the bridge, there was no bridge in 1801, but that was the road that separated their two farms. And they were only here for a short period of time when they realized that the low point in a river where people forded, where they went across, that they could use the service of a boat or a ferry. And what they actually had was they had a boat with pulleys, ropes that pulled across the river. They charged you 3 cents, and if you didn't want to get your feet wet, they would take you across. Now, when I say that, in the summertime, you could actually walk across the river. There's a shelf there, and you could actually walk across, and you'd only have the water, wouldn't even be quite up to your knees. But if you didn't want to get your feet wet, they would be glad to take you across.
Now, you mentioned the railroad. Now, was that the Pennsylvania Railroad?
Well, in Spring City, we had the Pennsylvania Railroad. That's exactly right. On the other side of the river in Royersford, you had the Philadelphia and Reading, and later it became the Reading. Of course, the Reading Railroad The Philadelphia and Reading came in 1839. We're over in Spring City. You didn't get the Pennsylvania Railroad till the 1880s. So Rural Sport had a railroad first, but Spring City did have the Pennsylvania Railroad.
Now, students of railroad history know that the Pennsylvania Railroad, I believe, was the dominant railroad for decades around the country. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, that's correct. Unfortunately, for people that lived in Spring City, the passenger service stopped about 1955. We're over in Roersford. The passenger service was up into the 70s, but the original tracks still run freight trains today. Now, we don't have as many freight trains, but, you know, just 10 years ago, we had 10 to 15 a day. Now it's down about 3 or 4, but there's still trains going through Roersford. Spring City hasn't had any trains in many years.
Mm-hmm. Now, just back to the museum. I think you moved to your present location with the help of the Bard Foundation with a grant, and then just describe. I think you have several different rooms with a library and a cobbler shop. Describe your location.
Yes, the main house has 8 rooms and a library, and every one of the rooms is filled with artifacts and stuff that people have donated. And then we have the cobbler shop, which is a separate building, but it looks like it's attached to the house. It's not. It just sits there. That was built in 1875. That was John Milton Lewin. He was the oldest son of William, and he had a cobbler shop out front. And then when he moved to bigger things, he had a bigger shoe store downtown, and then later on he became part owner of Grander. They moved his little shoe shop up around the back of the house so that when you come in our driveway, it looks like it's part of the house. It's actually a separate cobbler shop. And then we have what we call the gallery now. It was originally what we called the Barn Museum, and that houses all of our industrial displays, our stoves, glassware, and our school display. So we have 3 buildings, and every one of them is packed full. We pride ourselves in putting as much as we can possibly put out on display for people to look at.
Mm-hmm. You've got really a very impressive collection. In fact, every time I'm near Phoenixville, by the way, for our listeners, if you don't know where Spring City is, it's about 15 minutes or so from Phoenixville in northeastern Chester County. It's pretty close by. So if you're going to Phoenixville, take a few minutes and stop by Spring City. But their collection is really very, very impressive. The iron stoves, the glass collections, textile displays, it's really outstanding. And most of your items, I guess, have been donated by local people. Is that right?
Yeah, 95% of what we have been donated. And I just want to add one thing real quick. I get it in here. Everything that we've talked about today and these collections and inside of our museum and stuff is all on our Facebook page. We have a Facebook page, and it's just Spring Ford Area Historical Society. And if you go into the Facebook page, you can bring up our website. We have a website. You can bring up our phone number. You can bring up how to join. It's $15 a year to be a member. You get newsletters. But everything that you need to know and want to know, I've posted over 52 stories in 2015.
Excellent.
And they're all on the Facebook page.
Refer our listeners to your Facebook page. Bill, thanks so much for being on the show. Be sure to join us next Wednesday, the 20th at 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking with Ron Slotto, a hydrogeologist who's worked for the Geological Survey for 40 years, and his book on Chester County Mines and Minerals is fascinating, covering 300 years of Chester County mining history. Thank you all for joining us and listening in to Living History.